MacCast, Monday, June 12th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I am doing all right. I am fighting a little bit of a cold that's coming on. It seems to be going around here, at least on the west coast of California in the United States. I don't know how things are going for you, but this has been going around, and I know a couple people have been hit by this little sickness. So, you know, that's going on, but we have to soldier on, right? There's lots of things to talk about in the Apple and Mac community. Well, not maybe as much as there was last week. We're actually going to be doing a lot of follow-up this week, I think, is what's going on. We're going to be following up on a number of stories. We've got early impressions of Apple's new HomePod, some updates to iCloud to discuss. I'm going to get a lot more into some of the nitty-gritty of the stuff behind a number of the announcements and things that Apple talked about at the Worldwide Developer Conference last week. So get into the details as we often do now that people have had a chance to start downloading the betas, the developers, and playing with it. We're starting to hear some of the cool new features that are coming out. So we're going to dive into those pretty extensively, talk a little bit more about Apple's new hardware announcements and some new things that we've learned about there. Also, I'm going to flag or field a couple common listener questions that I got since Worldwide Developer Conference. We're going to do a little keychain access tips and tricks and also talk about stolen iPhones a little bit. Not my favorite topic to talk about, but something we need to get into. It's probably going to be a little bit of a shorter episode. I always say that, and then it ends up being just as long as every other episode. So I guess we're just going to have to jump in and see what happens. But before I get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Bitbucket. Let's be honest, if you're a developer, your code is your world. It's everything. You create it, you tweak it, you obsess over it lovingly every day, and picking the right repository management tool is really important. You want only the best for your code, right? That's why the team at Atlassian has created Bitbucket. Bitbucket is the Git solution for professional teams. They help over 5 million developers build with a purpose. They give teams of all sizes free private repositories with state-of-the-art features like the world's best pull request algorithm, also built-in continuous delivery, and integrations with your favorite tools like Docker, AWS, and Azure. Because Bitbucket comes from Atlassian, it also offers the best Jira integration available that gives your team everything you need to take your code from concept to customer. I've been a Bitbucket user on several of my own coding projects, and what I love about it is the ability to help keep all the code organized and, of course, managed and secure, and that really helps keep my projects on track. And I love the ease of setting up everything with Bitbucket, especially their integration with Amazon Web Services, because that was a key part of my project. We were building and deploying and auto-deploying to Amazon Web Services, and Bitbucket really helped keep everything straight. They also have some really unique features. So if you've used other code management systems, they have things like branch permissions that let you control who on your team can perform what actions on a branch based on branch type, branch patterns. You can set up all sorts of things. Bitbucket really is for the code that's going to take us to Mars, that decodes the human genome, or drives your next car. So visit bitbucket.org/forthecode to start your free account. It will let you use Bitbucket for your small team of up to 5 people for completely free. There's no credit card required, so try it out. That's bitbucket.org/forthecode. Try Bitbucket today. What will your code do? Big thank you to Bitbucket and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. So the media has had their chance to look at, weigh in, analyze at least a little bit the new Apple HomePod. In case you missed it, at Worldwide Developer Conference last week, Apple showed off their integrated speaker, home speaker, and voice assistant solution. So they really kind of focused mostly on the speaker side of things, it seems like, but we are going to get Siri built into a home product. And the reviewers, in my opinion, seem sort of cautiously positive, I guess is maybe the best way to put that. They're all saying the same thing. It's expensive, and hey, it's Apple, so we kind of know that, right? $350 or $349 for the HomePod, but it's got a lot of great technology in there. We covered all this in the last episode of the MacCast, so go back and get all the details in case you missed it. But, you know, you've got a giant woofer in there. You have 7 tweeters. You have 6 microphones and an A8 processor. There's a massive processor in there. And, of course, all kinds of audio processing, spatial awareness, all kinds of technology behind this thing. So you would expect it's going to be a little bit on the pricier side. And, again, it's from Apple. It looks beautiful, of course, white or black. Comes in this sort of cloth mesh, although one of you, we won't say who, sent me an email comparing the design to a ball of string. Which I can see it. It kind of looks like a ball of twine, a little bit, you know, white kite string or something like that. So that's a fair assessment. I think it's a little more beautiful than that. But as far as the price goes, you know, Apple's justification is that it's really trying to hit the mid to high end of the wireless speaker market, and also you have the Home Assistant in there, so it's really like combining the two products into one. A lot of the Home Assistant speakers really aren't that powerful. They aren't that great in terms of filling up a room with great sounding audio. And on the other side of the things, you've got wireless speakers that are really on the high end and can often run to prices much pricier than the HomePod. So, you know, Apple needs to kind of prove itself on both fronts, and it's not clear at this point if they really are, based on some of the reviews. Again, a lot of them noting that Siri is kind of the wild card in here. As far as the sound goes, you know, you can do a stereo pair of the speakers, but keep in mind that's going to push the price up, you know, well above $700 US. So pricey for sure. How does it sound? Well, a few select members of the media got to take a listen in a very controlled environment, but almost all of them agreed, hey, it beats the Amazon Echo, which really wasn't a surprise. I don't think that was a surprise for any of the reviewers, but they also put it up against a Sonos Play 3, which is a very decent, great-sounding speaker. I guess there's some argument over whether the Play 3 really sounds or is better than the Sonos Play 1s. I have a couple of Play 1s that I use in my surround sound system. I'm a Sonos customer owner. I spoiled myself a few years back and I got a surround system to replace my aging Dolby system. Yeah, Dolby like 2.0, you know, the original Dolby stereo system. And I love it. You know, I've got the sound bar and the subwoofer and a couple of Play 1s, and it sounds great. It fills up my room. I don't have a large space, but it works great, and I really like the sound. So the fact that the HomePod could hold its own against a Sonos Play 3 was very good. But again, this was a very controlled test. You know, Apple was picking all of the tracks that people were listening to, and I think it's fair to assume that the marketing team is going to pick something, of course, that is going to put the HomePod above the competition, right? So the jury's still out on, you know, we need to wait for these things to get in the market and for reviewers to have them in their own hands to be able to touch them and play with them. You know, they really weren't able to interact with it. They weren't able to use any of the Siri features. Jason Snell noted in his review that the audio processing technology was great for most music, but on a couple tracks, it might need, you know, styles of tracks, it might need a little bit of tweaking. Specifically, he said it kind of spread out the bass and the vocals in a way that made one of the tracks that they were able to sample, what he said, not quite sound right anymore. So the jury also seems to be a little bit more mixed about the bass response on the HomePod. Some of them were saying it's got a nice full bass sound. Many others were saying it's too much, and there's some speculation that may go back to, you know, Apple acquired Beats. It's fair to assume that a lot of the people that work on the Beats technology were involved in developing this HomePod product, and Beats has this reputation for having a large, almost maybe overdriven bass response. So again, that's not something I'm too worried about. A lot of people like the really big bass sound, and it does have a big driver in there, so it's not surprising that they can really pump up the bass. But again, it could come back to selection of music. It could also come back to tweaking. I'm also curious, at the end of the day, in software, I'm assuming there's going to be some sort of app for configuring and tuning your HomePod once Apple actually delivers it, and maybe you'll be able to adjust those things a little bit more. So say, hey, I don't want as much bass response sound in my music. I want it tweaked a little bit. You know, Apple's doing a lot of that automatically with all of the technology and audio processing in there, but, you know, there's going to be hopefully some ways to adjust that. So we really don't know a lot about the HomePod at this point. I think it's really too early to make any rash judgments about the sound quality versus anything else. You know, it's good that Apple was doing this because they did announce it and show it off, and a lot of us are very excited about it, myself included. But, you know, another comment on the sound was that there was no sweet spot. Which you often think is a good thing, right? You set up your speakers and you pick one location where that's sort of the best listening location in your home, and that's the sweet spot. The thing about the HomePod that many of the reviewers noted was as they moved around the room, the sweet spot was everywhere. And again, that's thanks to a lot of the technology, the spatial technology that Apple is building into this system. So it has that kind of advantage over some more, you know, static systems. And in case you're wondering, I saw a number of people asking in the comments on a number of their reviews if the Sonos system, the Play 3s, had been run through the Sonos system for setting up the space. I forget what they call the technology, but basically you can use your iPhone app, walk around the room, and you can have the Sonos technology tune the speaker for the space. I found a couple of reviews that said they did ask that question, and Apple, yes, they had tuned the Sonos Play 3 for the space that they were in. So if you're worried about that comparison, that was sort of taken care of. And finally, I think, you know, Jason Snell did make a valid point in his review about the fact that very often convenience will trump quality in terms of someone buying something. So this was coming back to, you know, why would you buy the Apple solution versus some other solution when there's other ones that maybe are higher quality, or there's a different quality and or level of quality. And really, people will choose convenience very often over that sort of thing. You know, not everybody. Audiophiles are obviously only care about the audio quality, but I'm thinking of things like, you know, MP3 is not the best audio format for music, but it is by far the preferred one that a lot of people use, and that just comes down to a matter of convenience. So if something is easy to set up, convenient to use, sounds really good, it maybe doesn't have to sound the best, and someone may choose it over something that sounds even better. So if Apple can make the user experience really great, then that's going to go a long way to helping them sell the HomePod. And Tim Cook did comment in a Bloomberg interview, again, this is something he said on stage, that Apple really put the audio first when developing the HomePod, that it was about the music and about the audio. And that, I think, led to some of the more questions and concerns about the smart part of the technology, the Apple and Siri intelligence part of the speaker, because it is also a Siri home speaker. You'll be able to use Siri with it. According to some of the early comments, it seems like the functionality could end up being a subset of what Siri does on your iPhone, so more tuned for the being a home speaker product. That, to me, if that's really the reality, in my opinion, seems the wrong direction that Siri should be moving in, especially if she's moving into my living room. I want that technology to be expanded on the HomePod, not confined or some sort of subset. I want more interaction, more intelligence. I want it to be smarter about the information that it's bringing back. And we've talked about all these things before, using more context, but more importantly, using more audio response. I should be able to ask all kinds of questions and get detailed audio responses back from Siri rather than being shuffled off to my iPhone or some other screen or something like that. So I'm hoping that Apple expands the functionality and that expansion also works its way back into the other parts of the ecosystem. On my my iPad, my iPhone, especially when I'm in hands-free operation sort of scenarios. And the technology should be smart about that. And certainly the A8 chip that's in there, it needs to be delivering power for something, and I'm assuming a big part of that is driving the Siri intelligence and the AI. Yes, the audio processing needs some pretty beefy processors as well, but a lot of that is often handled by dedicated audio processing chips that are also in Apple's systems. So I think they're going to be leveraging that A8 for a lot of the Siri functionality. And another concern that came up, there was a Wall Street Journal piece that quoted some former members of Apple's Siri team, and they were saying that Siri is still, quote, lagging behind the other intelligent assistants. And they say that it's mainly due to, quote, a culture that prioritizes user privacy, making it difficult to personalize and improve the products. So this is the whole data mining thing. They're saying it's about Apple not opening Siri up enough and tapping into enough of that data and sharing that data with, you know, Apple and presumably the world. Also, a little bit they say about not opening the system up enough to third-party developers, and that I sort of agree with. I wish Siri was a little bit more open to developers, but I understand Apple wanting to take a controlled stance on that. As far as the, you know, data privacy goes, I think I'm willing, and I don't know how you feel, I'm willing to give up some level of functionality, at least initially, so that Apple can figure out the user privacy in a good way. And I think they've done that. I think they showed a lot of that off and talked a lot about that at Worldwide Developer Conference, that they are going to be tapping in and mining more of the data that's on our devices, but leaving it there and doing all of the processing locally so that it doesn't have to go out to the cloud. It's not sent off to Apple. And to me, that's a bonus. I will pick the HomePod over some of the competition's products because of that privacy. And I think there's a lot of consumers out there that will. I think we're getting tired of being data mined over and over again by companies like Google and Facebook. I know I am. I'm getting really tired of it. And Apple's commitment to protecting my privacy is something that makes, in my mind, their offerings more valuable, even if maybe it's more difficult to implement and I might not get as many features as with those other systems as quickly. And a lot of people will argue, well, this is an assistant, so it needs to be able to do that. But I think there's a way to find a balance, and I think Apple is working toward that. And they're taking the hard road. They're not taking the easy road. And I certainly appreciate that. So Apple made the point, last thing to talk about on this, and I think this is a really important point. Apple made the point to reporters that what we saw at Worldwide Developer Conference was just a quote-unquote small sneak peek at what they're doing with HomePod, and that there were many more features to come. So I think, you know, we can't look at what was shown off there and really get a good picture of what the HomePod is going to be all about. I think there's going to be a lot more revealed in the fall about especially the Siri functionality and that side of things. Probably a lot of the HomeKit integration and the home automation stuff will come to light later on. And I think possibly even the design could change. I don't know if it would change much, but I still wonder, because of some of the comments Schiller made prior to this announcement about a home assistant speaker kind of system needing a screen, that little, you know, Siri glowing ball on the top, that seems like it could be made into a pretty nice little round screen. So maybe there'll be a couple different levels or options. Who really knows? But I'm still excited about the HomePod. I will very likely be picking one up when it is released in December. If for nothing else, just to play with it and compare it against my Amazon and see how it, and my Sonos system, and see how it sounds and report that back to you. So we have a long wait, unfortunately. I'm kind of excited about this product, but I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions on it. Even comments based on what you've read with some of the early reviews. Are you excited? What do you think? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. So, quick little update on iCloud. Apple kind of rolled out an update to the iCloud plans, at least on the top tier in terms of storage this week. They moved it from 1 terabyte to 2 terabytes for the same $9.99 a month US pricing. Of course, adjust that appropriately for your region, but it means that if you're on the top tier plan for iCloud storage, you just got your storage doubled. Unfortunately, only the top tier was upgraded. The other plans remain the same, so you get 5 gigabytes of storage for free. For 99 cents a month, 50 gigabytes of storage, and for $2.99, 200 gigabytes of storage. But something that is also coming and was part of, it was up on the slides at Worldwide Developer Conference, but wasn't specifically mentioned in the keynote. In iOS 11 and with macOS High Sierra, the next version of macOS, Apple is adding family sharing for iCloud, meaning that you can buy one of the storage plans and then share that storage amongst all the members of your family, possibly saving a little bit of money. For example, I am on the 200 gigabyte a month plan, so I pay $3 a month, but then other members of my family, two other members of my family, are using the 99 cents a month. So I'm really paying, what's that, $5 a month? And really our needs could all be served by the 200 gigabyte plan. So I may be able to drop $2 a month off of my plan and move to that. In reality, honestly, with this bump up to 2 terabytes, I will probably just move the whole family to the $10 a month plan. So Apple will likely get more money out of me, not less, but still it's good to see them shaking up the plans. And also about the same time this was announced, unfortunately for Amazon fans, Amazon announced that they were getting rid of their unlimited tier and moving that to 1 terabyte. So Apple now at a price per gigabyte is actually right in line, if not a better deal than some of their competitors out there who were doing a little bit better than them before. So storage, you know, is not, I think what storage providers are finding is they put out all these offers trying to win customers, and they're finding out that, you know, storage actually costs money. And if people are just getting a bunch for free, they are going to use it. I think the early thought was like it was classically in the days of the internet with bandwidth, that, you know, there's going to be a large number of customers that won't use all of the bandwidth or all the storage. But as we move more and more things into the cloud, that's exactly what's happening. So I don't know what they were thinking about, but that seems to be going on. So some updates to iCloud to look forward to immediately and then also in the near future. So really, some of the additional features in macOS High Sierra, iOS 11, you know, Apple showed us some really nice things during the keynote at Worldwide Developer Conference, but there has been a lot that has been discovered or revealed since the keynote. So I just want to kind of run down some of these, comment on a few of them. We'll try and move through them quickly, but there is a lot. There's a lot of things going on. So I did my best to kind of organize and break these up, but we might be bouncing around a little bit. So strap in, be prepared for that. User interface. A couple little cool user interface things that I noticed noted in some of the reviews and blog posts that have come up since Worldwide Developer Conference. The iOS volume indicator, when you change the volume on your iOS device, this is especially good for movies. They have moved that to the upper right corner. So instead of getting the big volume button that sort of covers the whole screen and goes right on top of your video when you're adjusting from the buttons, that will now just be a nice little indicator up in the upper right, and it looks really nice and clean. You now get support for landscape mode on the lock screen on all devices. I think this was something that was reserved for the larger iPads, if I'm not mistaken. Larger iPhones. Now you'll get that on all your devices. So if you pick up your iPhone, it's in landscape mode, and I think it's controllable. I think you can turn that on in the preferences if you prefer to have that. And then last used dates on applications in the usage section. So if you go into settings and about and usage, you now in the list of applications that you have installed on your device, you're going to get a last used date. So you know when's the last time I opened up this app. This is something I've wanted for a while so that I could know what to purge. And it also goes along with one of the new features that we talked about and was announced at Worldwide Developer Conference, which is you'll have the ability to turn on a setting that will auto purge any applications that you haven't used in a while. So if you prefer to do it more manually, it's nice to know you'll be able to go in the usage section and you'll be able to figure out what apps you've been using. So I thought those were some nice little enhancements to some of the UI areas of iOS 11. Here's a big thing in the Photos application, something I know a number of people have wanted for a long time. Now, I am not a huge animated GIF person, but GIF support, GIF support, if you prefer that, has not been really great in Photos. That is going to change. Now they're actually going to get support. So when you put a GIF into Photos, you get a little static thumbnail image. And then when you click on it or preview it, you actually get the motion. So you'll see the animated GIF going on. And they also will all automatically get organized into their own folder called animated. So you'll be able to quickly and easily organize and find them inside your photo library. So if you're a big fan of animated GIFs or GIFs, support is coming in Photos, both in iOS and macOS. So that's good to know. Here's a really cool thing, especially if you're like me and you're a fan of the reader mode in Safari. As a matter of fact, reader mode, by the way, I think is one of the most underrated and probably underused features in Safari. I use it all the time. In case you don't know what it is, if you go to a website, specifically a blog or anything that's doing more long form articles, and you just want a nice, clean reading view, you'll notice three little lines up in the URL bar on the right-hand side. If you tap on that, that goes into reader mode inside Safari. And what goes away is all of the website. You get a pop-up and just the text and the images of the article. No ads, or fewer ads, I think, in some cases, but just a cleaned-up interface for reading an article. And you can control some of the text size and how it's displayed. And I love reader mode. Safari in the next versions of the operating system is going to get the option to have an always-on reader mode. So as you're going through articles, you can just have them come up automatically in Reader. I will be enabling that. I can almost guarantee you. And you're also going to be able to customize per website settings. So some of the settings inside Safari, you're going to be able to tweak per website. I think this goes back to some of the security and privacy enhancements that Apple did talk about during the keynote. So you'd be able to tweak those based on the sites that you're going to and maybe open some up more. So if you have some of your favorite blogs that you're visiting and you don't want to block ads, I'm assuming you're going to be able to tweak those settings and let those ads come through so that they can get the revenue support that they need to keep going. So I think that's going to be ultimately a nice little enhancement and a good thing inside Safari. Apple talked about some of the new features and enhancements coming to Notes, including being able to access notes from the lock screen, which I thought was very cool. You can just do a quick note. There's going to be a button you can put in that customized control center to access that. But there were some other features that they didn't note during the keynote that I think a lot of you will probably like. Customized backgrounds. So your notes just don't have to have lines now. You can change the style of lines, whether you want more spaced out or less spaced out. There's also grids. So if you prefer more of the graph paper kind of look, you'll be able to set that up. They're adding support for monospaced fonts. As a developer, I often put some coding notes into the Notes application, so that's going to be handy to be able to use a nice monospaced font inside the notes and kind of switch between that. And they're also adding support for tables. So if you need to put tabular data inside your notes, you're going to be able to do that pretty quickly and easily. So some nice little enhancements and tweaks for Notes fans. We already mentioned the new control center. It is back on a single screen with a whole cacophony of little buttons and sliders and controls that you can put on there. It's mostly customizable. There's going to be 7 default items. So your wireless options, your music controls, the location lock, do not disturb, screen mirroring, so AirPlay, brightness, and volume. Those are all in there by default. You can move them around and kind of reorganize them, but those are the top ones. And then you now will have access to 18 extra controls that you can put below that Core 7. And, oh, I guess I have a note here. The Core 7 actually can't be rearranged. I haven't looked at this myself. This is just in my notes. So sorry if I got that wrong. They may not be able to be rearranged. But some of the elements actually then have additional controls that are accessed via 3D touch. So if you 3D touch on a slider or something, that pops up, or you 3D touch on the music controls, you get a music control player that pops up and you can interact with that. And if you don't have 3D touch, don't worry. There's also a tap and hold option for devices that don't have 3D touch support. So Apple has kind of thought about everything there, and all of that stuff is managed through the control center options inside the settings. So you can turn those on and off. And now control center does take up the full screen, so you have the room to put every one of those controls if you want sort of control center control overload on your screen. You'll be able to do that if that's something you really want to do. And another nice thing is iCloud file sharing, finally. Now, I don't have details on this, but what I'm assuming and what I'm hoping is that this is the ability to put something into iCloud and then just click on it and get a link that I can share with someone so they can download a file from my iCloud library without having to log in, without me having to do anything special. Something that's been missing from iCloud for a while, and I will be very happy to see that coming. We got some new details and more information about Apple's VR support and offerings, and also on their augmented reality stuff. I want to start with the virtual reality stuff, the VR stuff. It's going to work on the Mac now because of Apple's eGPU support. And we talked about this in the last episode of the MacCast, the ability to put better graphics processors in an external enclosure. This is going to work with Thunderbolt 3, so you're going to need to have a Mac that supports Thunderbolt 3, but there's going to be supported enclosures now. We've had external enclosures with Thunderbolt 2, but in the past, getting those to work with external graphics cards has been really difficult. Apple is opening up support for that natively now in the Mac operating system and with the new machines, so that should get a lot easier. And that means that you'll be able to get a graphics card that's going to work for some of these virtual reality headsets and technologies. So that's kind of one piece of the puzzle. Also, Apple is just integrating better GPUs in some of their newer Macs, including the new iMac Pro, which has is going to have a Radeon Vega processor. So that should be plenty of horsepower to drive VR. And we're expecting machines like the upcoming Mac Pro will be able to do that sort of thing as well. So between external GPUs for things like MacBooks and MacBook Pros and better internal GPUs, we're going to be able to get virtual reality support finally on the Mac, something PC users have had for a couple years now. Apple is also getting support for, or adding support from, the top three gaming engines for virtual reality, Unity, Unreal Engine, and Steam VR. So that's the other part of the puzzle, right? It's software, also support in macOS High Sierra because of Metal 2. So all of these things, all these bits and pieces, hardware and software, are now coming together. So far, if you're wondering about virtual reality headsets, what is Apple going to support? The only thing we know for sure is what they demoed, the HTC Vive headset. And it's expected that other support for other headsets are going to follow, because that really should just tie into the software support from some of the gaming engines like Unity, Unreal, and Steam VR. Of the people that have been able to try out virtual reality on the Mac setup, early reviews are good. It should be great and work at least as well as it is with the HTC Vive on the PC side of things. And I think the Vive is kind of the headset that's kind of gotten the most buzz outside of the Oculus system. And it certainly seems to be the one that a lot of my gaming friends and people I know seem to be picking up. I don't follow that industry, that side of things. So if you happen to be really into VR and you're a Mac fan, what do you think about this? I'm really curious. Is this important? Is this something that Apple really needs? Apple's never really been about gaming, and to me so far, virtual reality really seems to be living in that space. As far as Apple is concerned, Tim Cook has commented many times, and we've discussed this, that augmented reality is the thing that really excites them. And they did show off that amazing demo during Worldwide Developer Conference from Wingnut Studios with the game that sort of, you know, popped up on top of the tabletop, and all kinds of interactions were going on. So surface mapping and lighting, and they were doing all these great things, and they were adding ARKit, which is an augmented reality piece of Xcode that developers can use to help build and more easily build augmented reality experiences into their apps, both on iOS and I would assume on the Mac as well. But it's going to take some hardware to really accomplish that. So while the demo was really great, we're getting some details now on what is required with ARKit and how you're going to be able to create those experiences. So in addition to needing iOS 11, you are going to need a device with at least an A9 or an A10 processor. So that means an iPhone 6S or an iPhone SE or an iPad Pro or a 2017 model of the iPad. So really just Apple's newer systems are really going to be able to drive those augmented reality experiences. So just a heads up, if you have an older device that's not using an A9 or an A10 processor and you want to do all the cool new AR stuff with these new applications, you're probably going to have to step up and get a newer device. So that's kind of AR, augmented reality, and virtual reality, some of the more details and information we have about that. Another quick little thing with Spotlight. Spotlight search is getting some enhancements and improvements. One that I think a lot of people are going to look forward to is the ability to get airplane and airport information, so your flight information. And again, I'm hoping this is something that will be available for Siri to tap into, because it is an area where I think Siri has fallen short versus other systems like Google and Amazon. So to be able to ask, hey, is my flight delayed? What gate am I at? That kind of information should be available with Spotlight search, and I think by proxy within Siri, starting with iOS 11 and macOS High Sierra. Here's something really cool. If you're like me, you have friends and family that often come over to your house and they want to get on your Wi-Fi network. There is now a new Wi-Fi password sharing feature that is going to be available in macOS High Sierra and iOS 11. And it will give you the ability to basically beam the Wi-Fi password from a device that's already connected on your network and give that to another device trying to connect to your network. And the way you do it is you just hold the device that you want to connect near a device that is unlocked, an iOS device or a Mac that is unlocked that already has the Wi-Fi password, and then it'll just say, hey, do you want to send this over there? And you say yes, and the person says, yep, I got it, and they will be immediately on the network without having to type in or enter the password at all. They'll just be approved on your network and be able to get in. So that is really, really cool and saves a lot of typing. If you're like me, I set up, of course, really secure passwords, and often my guests are a little bit miffed because they have to type a complex password. Of course, I try to just send it to them so they can copy and paste it, but still, you get the idea. This is going to make things a lot simpler. You can now use multi-touch, of course. Apple showed that off, that you're going to have the ability to multiple select and move things around, especially in their new Files application. But it's also going to be available in other areas, including your home screen for moving apps around. So in the same way you could move files around in the Files application, you can grab one application, hold on to it, and then just start tapping the others, and they will start to swoop under and gather under your finger. And you can do it with both files or applications and folders, and then you can simply move them around. So no longer having to do the sort of application shuffle, as I call it, when you're trying to gather things up and move them around from one screen to another. So if you're big on app organization on your home screen, I think this is going to help out a lot. Couple new full screen effects are going to show up inside Messages. Apple is adding something called Echo, which will take all of your little message bubbles and have them spin around, go here and there. And then also a Spotlight full screen effect that will put a little spotlight animation on your message as you send it. Unfortunately, if you're a big fan of bubble effects, there are no new bubble effects, at least not yet, or being shown off in the early demos. So nice little enhancement to Messages. The one thing about bubble effects and full screen effects, I'd be curious. I've played around with them. As far as day-to-day usage of them goes, I really don't use them that much. I'm curious if anybody really does. Really, the only time I accidentally used one was when I sent someone a birthday message, and it happened automatically, which I actually wasn't too pleased about. I don't know if anybody's noticed that, but if you send someone a happy birthday message on their birthday and the system knows about it, it will automatically apply the birthday balloon sort of effect, and whether you want to or not. So that's kind of interesting. I think that's, you know, the AI trying to be smart. But in this case, for me, I think it was being a little bit too smart. We're all fans of podcasts, right? I'm a fan of podcasts. I'm assuming that because you're listening to this, you're a fan of podcasts. There's going to be some great new enhancements to the podcast app. First and foremost, it's getting an all new look. Apple, I think, talked about this at WWDC and they showed it off a little bit. It's going to be divided into sections, just like the music app, starting with a listen now area, which will now become the main area with your new podcasts, stuff you're currently listening to, etc. So that's kind of your daily area that you're going to go into to interact with your podcasts. Then you have the library tab that's going to show everything that you're subscribed to with all the shows and episodes and anything that you've downloaded, any stations that you've set up around different kinds of podcasts. And then there, of course, is a browse tab, which is basically your window to finding new shows, accessing shows that are in the iTunes directory and things like that. And one big new enhancement that I think is going to be good for certain kinds of podcasts, not something that's, I guess I fall in the what Apple is now calling the episodic category, meaning that I put out episodes every week. I don't have particular seasons. You just generally, if you're a new subscriber, you're wanting to just start jumping in with the most recent shows. And if you want to go back to the back catalog, you can kind of do that on your own. Of course, the app will let you flip that around if you want to start with the oldest one and listen through 600 episodes of the 600 plus episodes now of the MacCast. You certainly can do that. I encourage you. Actually, you can't do that. I only put about 50 in my feed. That's just to save people from accidentally downloading too many episodes. But I may be able to actually change that with some of these new enhancements. So that's episodic, and that's kind of the podcast we know, but Apple is adding support for seasons. This is for shows that kind of divide themselves into seasons, and they can now define it and say, okay, this is season one, this is season two, and they can build it into their feeds. What that means for you as a listener is that when you find a season, you can choose to start the season from the beginning, not with the latest episode. So you're going to get the first episode of season one first and then be able to go through to the end and then move on to season two. Or you could start with season two if you want. And a nice little thing is that if you want to download your podcasts, you don't stream them, you can actually download by season. So if you're getting into a show that maybe already has a few seasons in the can, you can download all of season one right to your device so that you can listen offline, all that sort of stuff. So that's going to be great for those kinds of shows. Another nice little feature, and I don't do too many trailers or bonus episodes, but occasionally I do. You now will be able to tag those as well within your episode list so that they can be treated differently. And you can say, hey, I want you to just stick to the main episodes and sort of skip over. I'm assuming you'll have the ability to kind of skip over the bonus or the trailer episodes, or sort of set them aside to listen to separately, so that they're not sort of intermingled with the main content, which is going to be really nice. And then on the podcaster side of things, Apple did announce that they're going to be adding some analytics that you're going to be able to tap into through iTunes Connect, which is going to be really helpful for us. It's going to be all anonymized, so it's not, you know, again, Apple focused on privacy. I'll be able to go in and get data about what shows people are listening to, which shows are most popular, where people, you know, how far people are listening to shows in. I'm hoping it'll maybe even show me how people are bouncing around, something that I've always been curious about since I do an enhanced podcast with the chapters, you know, how many people are listening beginning to end and how many people are sort of bouncing around between different sections. So that should be very helpful. Unfortunately, of course, that's only going to work for people who are listening through Apple's podcast app. It's not supported by any of the third-party podcasting apps. You have to be sort of listening within Apple's entire ecosystem that they're controlling, and that's so that they can get the analytics and, of course, anonymize it, make sure it's private and all those sorts of things. But some great new enhancements for podcasts, and I'm looking forward to playing around with those and checking those out. Um, A couple things are actually being left behind in the next series of updates. Probably the biggest one, which really shouldn't be a surprise. I saw so many people reporting on this like it was, you know, the apocalypse was coming. But, you know, 32-bit applications are no longer going to be supported in this version of the operating system. In the current iOS 10, Apple warned us about this. They said, look, in the next major revision of iOS, 32-bit applications are not going to be or are not going to be supported. They're not going to work anymore. And we talked about this before iOS 10 came out. So I don't think this is a surprise to anyone. In case it is a surprise to you and you want to check and see what apps you might have or rely on that are still running 32-bit code, if you go into settings on your iOS device with the latest version of iOS 10 installed, you can go to settings, about, and into applications, and it will show a list of what they're calling the slow apps, or apps that might run slow on your system that don't have updates. These are the apps that are 32-bit only apps, and those will stop working unless the developer recompiles them for 64-bit and puts out an update before iOS 11 is released. So if you're concerned, if you have one of those apps, you might want to try reaching out to the developer and just encourage them at this point to upgrade their application. Now, some of those apps are so old, they've just moved on. You know, a lot of developers have moved on, and I have a few of these apps installed on my system, and I'm going to have to go out and find alternatives. Unfortunately, there's not always alternatives for everything, or maybe the alternatives aren't as good as the 32-bit original, but it's what's happening for progress. And since the operating system, iOS 11, is also going to be 64-bit only, that does mean that some devices are going to be left out for the iOS 11 upgrade. That would include the iPhone 5, the iPhone 5C, the iPad 4th generation and earlier, and the original iPad mini. So if you have any of those devices, just be aware you're not going to be able to run iOS 11. And if you use two-step verification, another little change to be aware of when we transition to iOS 11 or macOS High Sierra is that you are going to be automatically switched over from two-step verification to two-factor authentication. And really the main change there is just how you authenticate. You're not going to be asked to send a code from your, or have a code sent to your device. What happens with two-factor authentication is all of your devices just get a pop-up, an alert that says, hey, someone's trying to log into your account. Here's where they are. We've talked about the fact that the geolocation data can be off a little bit depending upon your device, but you know, you'll get a notification. Someone's trying to log in from your device right to your account right now. Is this okay? And then you say okay, and then the code is sent out sort of automagically. So it happens a little bit more automated than two-step verification. Two-factor authentication is a little better system, and Apple is just making everybody move to that with this next operating system update. So if you're not on that, it's going to happen automatically. You won't get a choice. And another thing that's going away is the social login settings in the settings area of iOS. So that's Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, Vimeo. You have a section in settings right now where you can put in your account information, and then third-party apps can just tap into that. So they don't have to ask you for your Twitter credentials. Apple is pulling that out, but they are opening an API for developers that is like a single sign-on API, I think, that they have to integrate. So I think it's just handled a little bit differently. You just don't have a global universal area for those settings. I think once you've set it up in the core app, like the Facebook app or the Twitter app, you can then open that up to third-party apps to be able to tap into more directly. I'm assuming that's how that's working. I don't have full details on that, but I'll be looking into that a little bit more and filling you in on that in future episodes of the MacCast as we hear more about that feature and that change. So those are some of the things that are kind of going away that you might want to be aware of with the next operating system update. And then a few other odds and ends related to other devices like the Apple Watch. In Apple Watch, you're now going to have the option to not have your apps listed in the bubble grid anymore. You can get more of a list view that might be easier for some people to scroll through and find apps. I think it's going to be better because the list view actually shows the application name, and sometimes I can't tell by that little icon on my Apple Watch screen. What is that app? I have to kind of jog my memory and remind myself. Some of those icons can be a little bit ambiguous, so you end up just maybe having Siri launch the app or something like that. And the other thing I think we've commented on, but I'll just bring up again, if you have AirPods, separate tap gestures for each AirPod. So I think currently with the AirPods, you can have the double tap on the right AirPod for Siri, or you can change that to a double tap for play pause of your music. Apple is also adding the ability to do skip forward or skip backward with a double tap to the AirPod. And you can, again, set up the left AirPod separate from the right AirPod. So you could have double tap for Siri on the right AirPod, for example, and then skip forward on the left AirPod. So you'll be able to do more music control, have more control with your AirPods. And I am still a huge fan of the AirPods. I don't know if you've had a chance to try them out or use them, but by far and away, one of the best accessories Apple has made in a long, long time. Well, I guess I shouldn't say a long time because I love the Apple Pencil as well. But AirPods, I think, are just great, and I can't recommend them enough, really. And then finally, tvOS is getting a couple of nice little enhancements. The dark and light themes will be able to be switched based on time. So if you sort of prefer to have a dark theme in the evening and maybe more of a light theme during the daytime, you can set that up to happen automatically. And if you have multiple Apple TVs, this is going to be nice. You can set up home screen syncing. So if you've configured the Apple TV in your living room with sort of the perfect layout of your home screen where all your applications are, put everything into folders, gotten it all organized, and you want to sync that over to every other Apple TV in your home, you're going to be able to do that with just a simple setting. And I know there is a ton of other features and enhancements and things that are coming in iOS 11 and macOS Sierra and watchOS and tvOS and all the other OSs. Obviously, we could go on probably for hours and hours, but I don't want to do that to you. If you have some new feature, though, that you've heard about or you've run across that you're particularly excited about, shoot me an audio comment, just a quick comment, and let us know about the feature and why you like it and what you think about it. Send those to maccast@gmail.com, and maybe we can share some of those with the community, some of the ones that I haven't mentioned here or haven't been previously mentioned on episodes of the MacCast. And I look forward to getting those from you, because this is how I learn about this stuff, is through the community. I mean, I try and read everything that I can, but obviously, occasionally some stuff slips through the cracks. So share that information with us. And thank you in advance for doing that. And that's just some of the things that I've heard about with the latest OS updates that I wanted to kind of fill you in on. The other bits of information that we're getting since Worldwide Developer Conference, and the thing I want to finish up with for the news for today, is hardware stuff. Apple announced a bunch of new hardware, which is a little bit unusual for Worldwide Developer Conference. Usually we get maybe one piece of hardware, but this time around we got a bunch of stuff, including iMac updates, iPads, and new MacBook Pros. I want to start off with the new 2017-inch updated MacBook Pros, because we're starting to get benchmarks and tests arriving, and it looks like those new Kaby Lake-based models got a pretty nice performance boost. The reviews are kind of saying between 10 to 20%, depending upon the model. This is over the 2016 editions, which Apple just released in December, the end of last year. So the largest bump being up on the top end. So the 20% increase is on the top of the line model over the previous top of the line version. But even the new non-touch bar 13 inch, the one that got a price drop, $200 price drop, is getting about a 20%, I think, improvement in terms of performance. So it's a nice little bump up. I don't know that it's enough, in my opinion, if you purchased a 2016 edition to be really too worried about. I wouldn't say it's like a must-have upgrade, and that seems to be where the reviews are falling. So, you know, you don't have to worry about it too much, I guess, is what I would say. The other one little thing that came out that I didn't really notice with the 2017-inch MacBook and that non-touch bar 13-inch one, the one that got a $200 price drop, is part of that price drop came about because Apple dropped the stock flash storage amount that's in there down to 128 from 256. So you lost half the base storage, and that's probably where a nice little chunk of the profit margin was made up with that price drop. So something to just be aware of if you thought, oh, Apple, great, they've dropped the base price model $200. That's so nice of them. Yeah, Apple's not always really that nice. And I didn't catch on to that. They slipped that one under my radar, so I wanted to make sure that I pointed it out to you as well. iFixit did its number on the new 4K iMac. So Apple did a rev to the iMacs. Again, everything getting Kaby Lake new processors. And it wasn't just new processors that were changed. They found some significant new internal changes. They looked at the 1299, the mid-range 3.0 gigahertz stock option. And what they found was that the RAM is not soldered on the motherboard like it was in the past. There's actually SODIMM slots in there, and the memory's in slots. They also found that the CPU is in a standard CPU socket. So it's in there, but it's under a bunch of "this will void your warranty" stickers. So if you want to take the CPU out and replace it with a newer one, you're obviously going to void your warranty. But by the time you want to do that, it probably is at a point where it's not under warranty anymore. So it is upgradable in terms of RAM and CPU. And I say that with a grain of salt because it is not officially user upgradable from Apple. Obviously, they're saying it's going to void your warranty. And it's especially not user upgradable because you actually have to break through the adhesive seal, the glue seal, that is on your display. The display has a seal around it, and you need like a special tool, or I guess you can probably do it without a special tool, but like iFixit makes a very special tool if you need to get in there. So it's not easy to get in and upgrade your machine, but it is a significant design change from the previous version, where everything was just soldered on. You had no option for doing any upgrades. So if you're really a big person that like I need to be able to upgrade this, there is some hope. Now, this particular model that they tore down did have a standard 1 terabyte hard drive, so we don't know about the flash modules, although they did note that there wasn't the SSD sort of flash daughter card slot that we've seen in some Macs before. So that seems to indicate that the flash memory, if you choose to go with that option on your new iMac, is probably still going to be soldered on the motherboard. But who knows? We're going to have to wait for another teardown to find that out. But positive news is it seems to be that Apple is moving maybe back toward slots. Why they're not giving you, if they're going to use the DIMM slots, though, this is just, I mean, I just shook my head because it's like, why can't we then have those in a place or a position where they can be behind a simple door so that we can do the upgrade ourselves? And they've had it in the past. They went away from it. I'm hoping this is a baby step toward that coming back in the future. I think consumers have said with enough vigor, with enough, you know, loud voices, we want the ability to put in our own stuff. Now, that said, and we had this conversation on the Mac show, is a number of us have noted that anytime we've put third-party RAM in our devices, very often that can lead to some trouble. I've had situations, and I buy high-quality RAM. I'm still a big fan of Crucial or OWC for buying RAM, and I think they do a great job with compatibility. But every once in a while, you'll just end up with a batch that, for whatever reason, has some issues. And you take it out, you put Apple stock stuff back in, and it works great. And I think this was Apple's attempt to kind of, you know, close the loop, make a closed system that they know is going to work and be reliable and be thoroughly tested and that they can control. But the reality is that many of us don't want to pay the price premium that Apple wants to charge for that, and we're willing to maybe take the risk. So I think Apple just needs to recognize consumers are smart enough and they understand the risks, and it's okay to just say, look, we're not going to support it when you bring it into the Genius Bar if you don't have stock RAM in it. And if it is the stock RAM, we're going to send you away and say there's nothing. It isn't the stock RAM, we're going to send you away and say there's nothing we can do about it. And that's okay. We've lived with that for a long time. So excited to see that there were actually slots in the new 4K iMac. And the question then becomes, what's this going to mean for the iMac Pro? Does this mean the iMac Pro is going to have a similar situation? What they showed on stage didn't seem to have any upgradability built in. It did seem to be the standard kind of closed system, but it does provide some hope that maybe if you drop $5,000 on an iMac Pro, or you know, even more, I think it's going to go up with all the custom configurations, could even go up to $10,000, $12,000, maybe even higher. You may be able to upgrade your investment at least a little bit in, you know, 4 or 5 years down the line, put some more RAM in there, something like that. Apple Insider also did some looking into how price competitive the iMac Pro is and tried to find out if you tried to spec out a similar PC, build one from the ground up, what price are you going to end up at? And the result that they found was that you could get pretty close, but not without making some significant compromises. They couldn't go spec for spec with what Apple was speccing out and get anywhere near the price. And the thing is we don't even know what the exact final components that Apple is going to put in there. But, you know, anything looking like Apple's base model, the 8-core Xeon, is showing that it's very competitively priced, at least with today's components, what's available on the market at current market prices. And that may be Apple's advantage, right? They're going to buy in volume. They're not paying retail prices for these components. They're paying a little bit less, so they can get more in there for about the same price. So despite the fact that the iMac, you know, on paper looks very, very expensive, it is a pro machine. It's targeted at the pro market, and it's got top-end components. It is a screamer. I think it's an amazing machine, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we get to one of the listener questions a little bit later in this episode of the MacCast. So stay tuned for that. Last thing that I want to talk about is the iPad Pro, the 10.5-inch. We're starting to get some of the early reviews of that model. And for the most part, I would say the reviews are gushing, glowing. People are loving the new 10.5-inch iPad Pro. And it's actually making me a little bit jealous, to be honest. I love my iPad Pro 12.9-inch. If you've listened to the MacCast for a while, you know that I am a huge fan of the iPad Pro and the larger size. I like it because I use it for taking notes. I love the split screen modes, and I'm looking forward to a bunch of the new enhancements. But the size, the idea of having a 10.5-inch larger screen in about the same form factor as the 9.7-inch iPad, I have to tell you, that's really appealing. Add to that the upgraded processor speed, more storage, better display, the faster response time for the Apple Pencil. A lot of reviews are talking about how smooth and buttery and great the new response rate is on the screen. That seems to be the standout feature of the new models, that is just a huge improvement over what is already really great. Like, the current models are no slouches. I don't think anybody would say that they were, but if that is that much better, that's just saying a whole lot. Of course, you have the awesome new camera updates, and it really does seem to be this best balance of size and portability. So you get a larger size screen. The only thing that's keeping me from buying another one, a new one, and selling my 12.9-inch is, beyond the price, is the fact that a few of the reviews have noted that, you know, the 12.9-inch screen still is kind of great if you want to good large display. And of course, I know I could get a new 12.9-inch model, but I'm not sure there's enough there for me to drop the cash on that. I mean, let's be honest, on the downside of things, price is an issue. You know, it is expensive. If you add an Apple Pencil and a smart keyboard to kind of make it that laptop replacement that Apple is trying to target it at, you're only about $200 away from the entry-level MacBook. And with that, you're going to get, you know, much better processor, the full Mac operating system, access to Mac applications, and all that sort of stuff. And don't get me wrong, I think a vast majority of people can do a lot with just an iPad Pro, but, you know, we're still at that level where there's certain tasks I think you really need a notebook or a desktop for. So I don't see myself personally at least going all iPad or just sticking with, you know, light portable laptop. I like having the choice and having both. But you know, who knows? We're getting closer, and especially with iOS 11 and a lot of the amazing iPad features that are going to be coming in that, with, you know, split screen and managing apps and files and drag and drop and all those sorts of things, it is moving and inching steps closer to being a true laptop replacement, I think, for a lot of people. But another thing mentioned in this these reviews, and I think it's valid at this point, is why did Apple release the iPad now? Why not wait until September when they had the operating system that seems to be designed for it to go along with it? And I think that's just a matter of Apple wanting to get, one, some of these announcements out of the way, and two, appease Wall Street and the press and people, you know, that are wondering, what is Apple up to? What are they going to bring us? And just based on the buzz and everything they're getting around the iPad Pro, I do think it has breathed some life back into the iPad. I think people are getting excited about the iPad again, and we're starting to get some of that buzz. And I think it's going to do very well. I think the next quarterly numbers are going to show that the 10.5-inch iPad is a very, very popular model of iPad. And I think you're going to see two different types of people buying those. You're going to see people who held off, had a 9.7-inch model, and had not upgraded yet. I think this is a compelling enough upgrade for them to jump in with both feet and upgrade. And I think there's going to be a lot of people like me who are sitting on the fence looking at this going, wow, I just bought a 12.9-inch iPad and I think it's great, but I really want a new one. I really do. I think I do, but I don't have the cash for it, so it's probably not going to happen. But if I did, I would be spending that in a heartbeat, I can guarantee you. So that's kind of the latest on what we know since Worldwide Developer Conference, and that is going to close out the news for this week. So I was surprised that during the keynote announcement, there was not certain kinds of things that I thought Apple might actually announce. And I received kind of a few questions from listeners that kept popping up over and over again since Worldwide Developer Conference. So I wanted to try and cover a couple of those questions for you. And one of the ones was I surprised that there was no Apple Touch Bar Smart Keyboard? This is something that's been rumored since Apple brought out the Touch Bar MacBooks or MacBook Pros, right? Are we going to see a keyboard with that technology integrated into it? Now, Apple did, if you listen to the last episode of the MacCast, they did finally bring out the thing that everybody had wanted in a keyboard for a long time, an extended version of the Magic Keyboard is what I mean. Apple Touch Bar Magic Keyboard. They did bring out an extended version of the Magic Keyboard, so you can have the number pad and the arrow keys and all that fun stuff, but no Touch Bar. And I would say that I wasn't surprised by that. I expect Apple to eventually release that. I think it is a product that will be out possibly even before the end of this year. I think, though, they're still trying to figure out if that technology has proven itself. I think they need more developers to kind of get in and play with it and figure out if it's a viable thing, if it's something that's going to stick around, if it's going to last. Apple obviously has invested a lot of time and effort into it, and I think they're going to do everything to ensure that it does last. And certainly Touch Bar Keyboard could probably help with that. I'd probably buy one. But, you know, is it going to be a flash in the pan sort of fly by night sort of thing? So I think they're still trying to figure that out. And I really see that as like a holiday item. I think come the fall, Apple could release that. So I wasn't surprised, you know, not to see it at Worldwide Developer Conference. I think they had plenty of other hardware to focus on. And even if that was in the lineup, I think timing wise, it probably just wasn't the time to do that. But that's just my opinion on it. If you have a different opinion, of course, share it with us. The other question that I received a lot was about the iMac Pro. And this was a huge response. Many of you wrote in and said, hey, what's going on here? You know, Apple did that event with a few select members of the media where they talked about their pro strategy and talked about the fact that they felt that the trash can Mac Pro, while they at the time thought it was the right thing to do, they realized it wasn't as well received by the pro community as they were hoping, and it didn't really serve all the pro customers that they wanted to serve, and they were kind of backpedaling on that. They were going to go back to the drawing board and redesign and rebuild and bring out a Mac Pro that has the features that, you know, that type of professional is looking for. And at the same time, though, they did mention, hey, we're also going to have some kind of Pro offering in the iMac lineup. They said there's a number of Pro users that are iMac users, and we want to deliver something for them. So the question that I was getting is, you know, is the iMac Pro Apple's offering to replace the Mac Pro? And absolutely not. I mean, the answer to that is emphatically no. Apple said so themselves. It is a machine, however, that is designed for that customer, I think, who is the current customer of the trash can Mac Pro, the person who loves the trash can Mac Pro and the fact that it's not upgradable. And believe it or not, there are a lot of people that like the fact that this is a simple little box. It's designed to work incredibly well with the components that are built into it when I buy it. It's fully supported. It works great. It does all the things that I want it to do. It has all the expandability in terms of ports and Thunderbolt and all the stuff that's on the outside. There are huge fans, and Apple knows this. And there are also Pro fans that are huge fans of the iMac. There's a bunch of pros that are using the 27-inch iMac current, you know, the 5K version, that wanted more. They wanted more raw power, more ability to do things. And that's who this machine is for. And I think there's a lot of people who are very excited about it. You know, this thing has 4 Thunderbolt 3 ports on the back. So the eGPUs are an option for upgrading. There's going to be all kinds of expandability through Thunderbolt that you can do with that. And it's a desktop machine, right? So who cares if you've got a few things hanging off the back of it? For a pro, I don't think that's a big deal stopper. So I think there's going to be a lot of people that jump in on this. The question I have is it going to be too much machine, and will it possibly cannibalize some sales of people who might buy the new Mac Pro when it comes out? But it's certainly not a replacement. Apple is still working on some sort of modular Mac Pro system. I'm assuming it's going to be a massive tower with tons of slots and tons of expandability and the ability to expand RAM and to put a RAID array inside. I mean, I think it's going to be a beast. I frankly wouldn't be surprised if maybe even it was a cube in terms of the design. I would love to see Apple do their take on a next cube. Wouldn't that be amazing? And that would be the Pro machine. That would be sexy, right? That would be amazing. So whatever Apple's going to do in terms of design, I think it's going to be much more straightforward in terms of its modularity, expandability. It could be a series of components that sort of stack together. We've seen concepts around this, and that's been talked about in the community for a long time, where you can kind of customize. So maybe you have a base model that is the, you know, the CPU that you want, and then you have another module that's your graphics module, and you have another module that is any disk array that you need, and ports and all those sorts of things. So it could be very modular, almost like a, you know, a home modular stereo system was back in the 70s and 80s, right? Maybe take it that far. Who really knows what Apple's going to do? I just know they're going to really wow us. But as far as the iMac goes, no, the iMac Pro is a machine for a certain set of customers that Apple knows they have, and I think they're going to sell like hotcakes. I think you're going to see tons of photographers, videographers, people, and especially the fact that you can connect, you know, 2 more 5K displays to that, so you have 3 giant 5K displays. That is going to be an amazing Pro setup for a lot of customers, and I think be very popular. So no, it's not a replacement. This isn't the Pro machine. That's the modular, you know, meant to replace be the next thing after the trash can Mac Pro, I guess was what I'm saying. There is another system that's meant to replace the trash can Mac Pro, and it's not the iMac. Sorry if I got a little bit rambly there. I know I'm pretty excited about this stuff. But that's some of the common questions that I've received from you since a Worldwide Developer Conference. So here's something new that was sent in to me by Fernando. It's a new trick, and I always love it when I think I've learned everything there is to know about a certain segment of the Mac ecosystem and Mac applications. And this one is related to keychain access. For those of you who don't know, keychain access is the app that allows you to view and manage all the logins, certificates, and passwords that are stored on your Mac. So if you're in Safari and it says, hey, do you want to save this password? Or if you're in any part of the system, do you want to save this password? That password goes into your keychain, part of the operating system, and the application to manage that is in your utilities, applications utilities. It's called Keychain Access. And you can open up that application and you can kind of browse through and see all of your things that you've saved in there. And as a matter of fact, one of my favorite tricks related to Keychain Access is that you can actually go in there and find a forgotten password. How many times have you had a family member or a friend, they are trying to log in somewhere and for some reason it's not coming up in Keychain Access, or they just forgot their password, maybe it's an older one. If you tell them, you can go into Applications, Utilities, Keychain Access, and then on the left-hand side, select Passwords from the Category section. And then up on the right-hand corner, there's a search box. Just search for the password that you're looking for. So say I was looking for my password for Flickr, right? Flickr.com. I could type Flickr.com into that search box. And if I've saved my Flickr password into the keychain at any time in the past, that's going to pop up. I can select that item in the list. And then down at the bottom of the window, there's a little info icon. Or I think I can use the keyboard shortcut, you know, Command I for get info. That'll bring up the info window, and inside that info window there's a little checkbox that says show password. You check that and then your Mac will prompt you for your login password for your Mac. You enter that in and it will show you the password right there in Keychain Access. This feature you can actually also do inside Safari, inside the password section, something similar. But what if you have a password that's in the keychain that's not just like a web password, not something that Safari saved, to say it was a FTP password or some other password inside an application? Those are also available inside Keychain Access. So that's my favorite trick inside there. But Fernando's trick is an easy way to be able to lock your Mac when you step away from your machine. And I get asked about this all the time. I think we covered the keyboard shortcuts that you can use. Well, Fernando says if you go under Preferences in the Keychain Access application, so open up Applications, Utilities, Keychain Access, and then just go into the Preferences, and in the General tab of the Preferences, there's a little checkbox that says Show Keychain Status in the Menu Bar. And when you do that, you'll get a little lock icon in your menu bar, and it will show you whether your keychain is locked or unlocked. And the way the keychain works is when you log into your Mac operating system using your Mac user login, it automatically gets unlocked. And then anything that is stored in the keychain has access to those keychain passwords for auto login and all that stuff. You know, the stuff that you save, that's just how it works. Well, with the little lock in the menu bar, for one thing, you can just lock your keychain. So if you want to just secure the keychain and make sure that, you know, nothing has access to that, then you can do that. Of course, if you're going to try and open an application or go to a website that wants to use that keychain, it's going to prompt you again for your Mac login. And you can just enter that in and it'll unlock the keychain. But also in that menu, there's an additional option that says lock screen. So now you can just go up to the little lock icon if you're going to walk away from your Mac and you want it to be secured. You can just hit that and it will automatically lock your screen for you. So when you come back, you'll just have the lock prompt. And at the same time, when your screen is locked, the keychain is also locked. So you can protect your Mac. And I thought that was a cool little tip. Now, I would also advise and recommend that you set up your Mac to require the password after it goes to sleep, and you can do that in the security and privacy system preferences. So if you go into system preferences, security, privacy, go to the general tab, you can check the require password after sleep or screensaver begins, and then you can set the duration. I set mine to immediately. So the minute my Mac goes to sleep, it is also locked. And I do that again to protect all my data and privacy. So if I step away, and what's nice about enabling this feature is if you enable that, then you can use a couple of simple keyboard shortcuts to lock your Mac. You can press Control Shift Eject if you have an external keyboard with an eject key on it. And once you've enabled the require password after sleep or screensaver begins option in security and privacy, that will work as a keyboard shortcut to lock your Mac. If you're using the internal keyboard that just has the power button, it's Control Shift and power. So if you don't want to, you know, do the menu thing with clicking and selecting that, you can go with that option. So a couple different ways to lock your Mac, and one that's accessed through Keychain Access. And thank you, Fernando, for sending that in, because I had no idea that menu even existed. So that I thought was a great little tip to pass along. And if you have a tip to share with the Mac community, MacCast community, it could be an iOS tip, an Apple, anything related to Apple or any of their operating systems, send those along, maccast@gmail.com. And audio comments are always welcome. The only thing I ask with audio comments is try and keep it down to, you know, a few minutes. 3 minutes is kind of a good sweet spot to try and shoot for. So quick little tips are always great to share, and we appreciate those. So send them along. And don't assume that that we know everything, because we certainly don't. I'm learning something every day, and it's part of the reason why I love doing the MacCast, and I love this community, because you always kind of, I always call it seeing things through new eyes. You know, new users to the Mac, or even old users to the Mac that learned something from some other user. That's how this stuff gets passed along. And we can't find out about it if you don't tell us. So we may know it, we may not know it, but I'm always happy to share those and pass them along. So please send them in. All right, last topic. I almost now kind of hate to end on this topic, but this is just how it worked out in the show notes. I have Scott, and he sent me a voicemail. He had a little issue this week, and he had some questions about what happened to him and wanted some of our help. So we're going to try and help him out. Here's what Scott had to say.
Hey, Adam, this is Scott from Chicago. I have a two-part question/comment. The first part is a negative that happened to me a couple weeks ago. I was at a park and had my iPhone 7 Plus stolen from me. A teenager, probably 15, 16 years old, approached me and asked me if he could use my phone to call his mom. Two things here. One, I'm a dad, and two, I didn't think phones were stolen that much anymore because all the security, passcode locked, etc. So can they even sell them? Like, whatever. But so I gave the teen my phone, and bam, gone. He ran off, threw the phone over a tall fence to his accomplices, and they ran off. So by the time the police showed up, I tried to find my iPhone and even tried to call the phone, but they had turned it off. I got home, did all the iCloud thing, set to erase, stolen, etc. But basically, my first question is, why do people still steal phones? Can they sell them? I didn't think they could, right? I have passcode lock. I have Find My iPhone on the thing. Or maybe the thieves figure 1 out of 10, 1 out of 20, whatever, don't have a pass lock. But still, once the owner tells the carrier Apple that it's stolen, can it be used again? Can it be sold? So that's the first thing. But there's a silver lining. I'm an iOS developer, and I kept my iPhone 5S around to test my work on a smaller screen. So now this is my everyday iPhone. And Adam, I know you didn't like the huge phone and went with the smaller size. Now I'm in that situation, going from the huge 7 Plus to a tiny 5S. And I'm enjoying it. It fits in one hand. Go figure. I mean, that Plus was a two-handed operation. You had to hit stop. You know, it's going to fall. Like, whoa, this is awesome. Downsides, obviously, this is three-year-old hardware, somewhere around there. So scrolling can be choppy. And I'm going from 128 gig to 32 gig. But Apple's done a great job managing storage with the photos, etc., to be on demand from the iCloud. So it wasn't too hard managing space. I mean, let's face it, I had 128 gigs and I had so much crap, like large games, etc., that I never played on my S Plus, but I had the space for it. I mean, gigs and gigs, so I didn't have to manage it, but, you know, so I just wiped them off this 5S and I have enough space. Worst part, the camera. That's the only thing I really miss. I don't even bother taking a picture on my 5S. I just cringe when I take a picture and I look at it and go, whoa, that's not good. Yeah, it's crappy that people are still stealing phones, but in the end, it's just a phone and can be replaced. But my main question is, can they do anything with this stolen phone? I asked someone and they said, yes, people will buy them for parts. What? Do they have a Liam around to take them apart? Huh, what? But anyway, great show, Adam. Thanks. Have a great day.
Hey, Scott. Thank you for your question, for your message. Sorry it's under such cruddy circumstances. I'll just start off by saying sorry. That just sucks that there's still people out there that do that. Unfortunately, I guess this is the world the world that we live in. But we try to be more positive here. I'm going to try and answer your questions on the just a comment on the photo thing. It's funny because we have raved. I know I have raved with every iteration of the iPhone at the quality of the camera. But I'm with you. I go back through my photo library and I look at some of those pictures that I thought were great back in the day, and then compared to the current technology in my iPhone 7, yeah, they don't hold up, do they? But they were great for the time. So I would just encourage you, remember, you know, still take pictures with your iPhone 5S. You still have the memories. I mean, that's what you're trying to capture mostly, ultimately, I think. And if that's the camera you have with you, it's better to take that picture than to not have that picture as a memory. And it was good. It was good enough back then. It should still be good enough now, I think, at least for, you know, what you're trying to do. So don't get too discouraged too much on that one. To answer your main question, though, I thought a lot about this after getting your message. I really don't know. My first thought was, and being a teenager, I'm not sure that they would be this sophisticated, but one thing I could think of was he did ask you to use the device to call his parents. So I'm assuming that you handed to him unlocked. And it could be possible that what they're going after is the data on the phone, that when he threw it over the fence to his accomplices, they made sure that they kept it awake. I don't know what your timeout on it was, but, you know, most of us, I think, set it to a couple minutes, probably not immediately, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. So it could be that they're trying to data mine what's in the device in its unlocked state. And they may have just thrown it right into airplane mode to stop you from being able to, like, track it or do any of the find my iPhone, you know, passcode lock sort of remote lock sort of thing. So if they're sophisticated enough, they could probably get it in a mode once it's unlocked where they could go in and maybe mine that data. And some people, I'm assuming not you, but the reality is some people store passwords on their device in like a text application or inside notes. I know people who do this, and I strongly encourage them not to do it, but you can't change people's behavior. So it could be that they might data mine and look for your iCloud password. And if they can find your iCloud password in the Notes app, they could potentially turn off Find My iPhone and turn off the activation lock with it. And then they're free and clear to sell your phone. So just like you thought, you know, maybe that's some of what's going on there, right? Is that they're trying to do that. The other thing, and I think the more likely scenario, is that they probably just try to simply sell it activation locked to some poor unsuspecting buyer. I mean, the parts thing is an interesting theory, but I think there's probably enough gullible people out there that they could just say, oh, I want to upgrade. I'm selling my old phone. And right, people would not even know that there's not an upgrade to the iPhone 7 Plus. But you give a good story and you look innocent enough, you're a teenager, and someone's probably going to give you a couple $100 for it. And they're not going to know until it's too late that it's activation locked and that it's stolen. A lot of people aren't even going to think to check or ask. So we're smart enough to do that, and we're smart enough to probably tell our friends and family and relatives to do that. But, you know, that's going on. Unfortunately, on the buying side of things, and I was really disappointed when this happened, Apple removed their activation lock checker tool back in January. I have no idea why. Nobody still to this day knows why. I wish Apple would come out with a statement on this. But they used to have a tool where you could ask the person, okay, once you get the device, you could go online and say, wait a minute, I want to check the serial number. And you could check to see if it was in activation lock mode. And then if it was, you could ask the buyer and say, I need you to deactivate the activation lock. So there was a check that, you know, could prevent that sort of scenario from happening where they just sell it to an unsuspecting person. But how someone would know, you know, again, I think you'd have to literally tell the buyer, I want you to turn on the device and I want you to show me that it doesn't have Find My iPhone turned on. Because if Find My iPhone is turned on, just like you noted, it's activation locked and they're not going to be able to reuse the phone. So I really think that the reality is, though, that they're probably just going to try and sell it to somebody who doesn't know better. And right, you can go from buyer to buyer until you find someone. Someone's probably not going to turn them in as stolen. They might just run away or whatever it might be, and you don't know anything about that person. So unfortunately, we still have bad people in our lives, and, you know, who knows what these kids' situation really is and how terrible it might be. I don't presume to know why people do the bad things that they do. But, you know, for the rest of us, we just try to be smart and good people. And I think your attitude about it is incredibly good. And you seem like a very nice person. And it sucks that this happened to you. Thanks for sharing your story, because I know that's not always easy. But there's many in our community that can kind of learn from it. So I appreciate you sending it in. Those are my theories. The community might have some other theories. If you do, send your comments in, and we'll try and share those on a future episode. But Scott, thank you for your comment. And I agree with you wholeheartedly on the smaller size phone. I think it's a perfect size thing, and I really enjoy mine. And not to knock the people who really like the big ones. I'm sure those dual cameras were really nice. That's one feature I'm hoping in the iPhone 8 that I'm going to be able to take advantage of when we get a nice size and form factor with that model. So I'm looking forward to my upgrade. Maybe you'll be able to save enough pennies by the time the new one comes out in the fall to get an upgrade again and be right back in there. So thanks a lot. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love getting your comments, your questions. Love hearing from you. You can send emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Or you can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. Feel free to contact me there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the forum. That's at forum.com. MacCast.com. While you're there, be sure to also check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You'd think after all this time I wouldn't mess that up. Yeah, but I did. If you're on social media and you want to follow me between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community, google.com/PlusMacCast. And I always forget, I probably should mention, there's a few other shows that I do. First is the iOS show. If you're more into iOS devices, iPhones, iPads, Apple TVs, all those sorts of things, Apple Watch, I cover that with my friends Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer and Michael Johnston. You can check that out at theiosshow.com. And also every week, usually Fridays, I am live at 8 a.m. Pacific time on the Mac show on the British Tech Network, and that's britishtechnetwork.com. So you can listen to that. You can also, of course, subscribe to that, the Mac show. Find it in your favorite podcast client, wherever you find podcast clients. You can find it in iTunes or, of course, your favorite podcast app inside the directory. So check those out, additional shows, but that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.